Bill Knowlton, the mayor of Bluegrass, the man, 42 years, I think he says, of having, and of course no one alive would know that because it's so long, 42 years of a radio program featuring bluegrass music in upstate New York. And Bill is a common fixture at all festivals, that many, many festivals. You'd look for the man in the fancy pants, and that would be Bill Knowlton. He knows so much about the history of bluegrass, and certainly bluegrass radio, and we had a nice chat off of the main High Meadow stage up in Grey Fox this year. I've been trying to work this out. Couldn't catch him last year, and we actually got together, and I was able to leave all my valuable equipment and sneak around behind the tent for about 22 minutes. So coming up right now, Bill Knowlton. It was enjoyable. Bill, thanks so much for taking the time to meet with a new feller like myself and chat about the history of bluegrass, which he knows I do not. But you get to share a little bit with it now with Bill Knowlton on Steve Martin's Unreal Bluegrass.
I'm very happy to have as my guest on Unreal Bluegrass, Bill Knowlton. Bill, how are you?
Glad to be here.
We're sitting up at the Grey Fox Bluegrass Festival. We snuck away from our various duties because I wanted to talk to you about the great history that you have with bluegrass. And let's start with, we were talking 42 years ago.
Bluegrass Ramble is into its 42nd year on WCNY-FM in Syracuse, Utica, and Watertown, New York. We started on the 21st of January, 1973, and if I knew that I would still be doing it, I don't know if I would have started it.
Yeah, but you're still doing it, and you still enjoy it as much as you ever got into it.
Yeah, sometimes it's a job, but I couldn't imagine being around without my microphone once a week.
Well, it does kind of get to be a sickness after a while.
Yes.
And you also are involved in, you do some promoting of your own at a festival?
I have one festival that I promote myself, and it goes back to 1973. It's called the Bluegrass Bramble Picnic, and it started in a year where there were no bluegrass festivals anywhere in New York State or New England, and surprisingly, without knowing each other, there were four bluegrass festivals that all started up in 1973.
At the same time.
Fortunately, not on the same dates,
okay.
But I'm the only one left, and I guess
you win.
Well, I'm sort of the Avis to the Hertz. I would be the oldest bluegrass festival in the northeastern United States, but the Delaware Valley Bluegrass Festival, held in Jersey, is 1 year older than mine.
Well,
now, if they move back to Delaware, I can claim that. Yeah,
because they're not continuous.
Continuous.
You are, in my opinion, I'm just a baby at even trying to do this stuff. You are, in my opinion, I always knew of Bill Knowlton.
Oh, wow.
You are the, I don't mean always, like my whole life, but at least when I was paying attention to bluegrass radio and stuff from the 70s, you're kind of the deacon. I'll just call you this. You're kind of the deacon of bluegrass radio personalities that I'm aware of. Because all the people that I was fans of, and still am fans of, those great players that I know and got to know, they all know Bill Knowlton. So you have a place in the music. You are as much a part of that stream, that continuous stream, as those musicians are at this point.
Fortunately, I have been in the right place at the right time. The first incarnation of the Bluegrass Ramble was 1959 to 1960, when I was a senior at Fordham University, and I had a half-hour show once a week on WFUV, which is still on the air, the Fordham University radio station. I called it the Bluegrass Ramble. My theme song was Wheelhouse by Bill Monroe, and the closing theme was Reno Ride by Don Reno and Red Smiley.
They were brand new tunes.
They were 45. And then after I graduated high school, I got one of these typical minimum wage announcing jobs at a small station, and this was in Torrington, Connecticut. And I talked the management into letting me on my own time do an hour of the Bluegrass Ramble on Sunday afternoons. And that was 62 until, I'm sorry, that was 60 until 62. Then I took a 12-year hiatus serving in the Air Force.
Thank you.
You're quite welcome. And
I don't know if you ever flew over Kentucky, but we thank you anyway.
Well, with the pair of glasses I have, if I ever flew anywhere, you'd be in deep trouble. I was what they call a ground pounder. I'll get that
right. All right. I got you.
And a public affairs officer.
Okay.
And it was the Air Force that brought me to Syracuse, with the 21st NORAD region. I got off of active duty, but I stayed in the reserve and started the radio show. When I got out, I got a job in Syracuse in public relations, and the ramble continues on. And now I'm retired. I can spend a little more time on putting it together and getting it recorded.
Because yeah, you were hardly putting any time in the radio before you retired.
I was. It was even. I don't know how I did a full day's job.
Isn't it? You get wound up in these
the show.
And all of a sudden, you think about it, you plan. Mm-hmm. And I'm coming from really a novice thing, but I know from my small contribution to this is you think it, you plan it, then you redo it, and you rethink it, and you try to make it just right. So you put a lot of hours, not behind the mic, but in anticipation of getting behind the mic.
I have learned how to. I have a certain formula for the show, and it takes me about 3 hours to perform a 3 hour radio get it ready. But if you look at the floor of my living room, it looks like a Jackson Pollock painting when I'm trying to put the show together. I have six pieces of paper, one for each half hour, and I'm just shuffling. This will go with that. That'll go with this.
Okay.
And so it does help if you have a set routine.
Now you are still using 45.
I don't use. Now's technology. If you want,
you can admit it if you do. I'm not going to.
Well, the thing is, I could, but it involves getting the staff to bring in a turntable and hooking it into the.
Tell the younger people what a turntable is.
Yeah, it goes around, and it, at 33, 45, and 78 revolutions.
And the math
per minute,
means nothing at this point. Just the image of it.
Slow, middle, and fast.
There you go.
Yeah. And we cue them up. Now, tell that to a modern engineer.
They have no idea.
Have no idea what you're talking about.
Something is in the queue when you're printing on your computer. That's all I know.
When I started doing the show, it was a 3 hour reel to reel tape, which was about the size of a pizza. And I did it live for the first 3 years, but having to be at my desk the next morning at 8 a.m., and in those days the show was from 10 until 1.
Wow.
And so I just learned to, tape it early on. I do time checks and everything so it comes off as a live show.
Okay, I got it.
And I don't just lay tracks, voice tracks. I actually do 3 hours real time, and while the record's playing, I'm thinking of what I'm
going
to say next.
Oh, I see. So you're not going in like they do now. They so much of the stuff they pull out of the air, and they go in and record it. I don't. I sit at my thing, and I do a three-hour show in 3 hours. Mm-hmm. But now they will, just for comparison's sake, pull things off of a satellite, go in and do like a 10-minute set based on what they think is going to happen Tuesday in the weather, and then they got 20 minutes of time in for a three-hour show.
No, it's I would do the show live if it wasn't Sunday night, after a full weekend.
Yeah.
But no, I insist on doing it the way we used to do it, and I'm still doing it.
Yeah, well, that's great. And you've gotten to know so many great performers in the bluegrass field, and people know you, and you can relate to all. When people come and talk about the players who did this and this, you knew all those people because of the originality of your show. They sought you out.
Well, it's just kind of fun. I'm 75 right now, New York City kid, supposed to be listening to pop music back in the 50s. In fact, I was listening to pop music in the 50s until I found out that all these pop songs were nothing but covers of country music.
That's right.
I mean, Joe Safford was doing Hank Williams and all that.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was this disc jockey that I listened to every day, and he said, Jambalaya is not really a pop tune. It's a hillbilly song, and I have it by the hillbilly singer who wrote it. It's somebody named Hank Williams, and just for fun, I'm going to play it. Well, instead of being laughable, I freaked out. I thought it was absolutely the most incredible thing I ever heard, and that was the first Hank Williams song. And I got into real country just as Hank died, and as I say, all the pop tunes were covers of country tunes back then. And then as mainstream country, which I was totally devoted to me just went into pop music, I just realized, for me, the only thing left was bluegrass.
Well, first of all, I appreciate you doing this. We're sitting at Gray Fox, and Red Wine is on the stage, and we can hear that in the background. But let me ask you this. There have been several waves of country music and pop music. When was the one you're talking about when you thought that the real country music started turning pop so that you found bluegrass?
I am such a moldy fig. It was the late 50s when Ferlin Husky recorded Gone and Sonny James recorded Young Love.
That was it for you.
Out went the pedal steel, out went the fiddle, out went the guitar, and Nashville and instead of trying to fight to keep it sound, just immediately caved in, and everybody went in that direction.
Right.
And so it was bluegrass. Where the diehard country music fans, they just went over to bluegrass. And bluegrass, I once said, it was invented in 1945, and it's been dying ever since. You know? all the reports of it, nobody's listening to it. No, Well, we took it over. That's what happened. When the major record labels dropped bluegrass, we formed our own labels. We formed bluegrass associations.
That's a good point.
But the thing that really saved bluegrass music were bluegrass festivals. And the very first bluegrass festival was really going to be a farewell to bluegrass. Carlton Haney down in Virginia put together what was left of touring bluegrass bands.
Really?
Which happened to be the Stanley Brothers and Bill Monroe and all the wonderful bunch, Reno and Smiley. And they say that fathers took their sons to see it, like waving goodbye to the last steam engine.
I've never heard this before.
And it was it wasn't said out loud.
Well, Julie didn't say come on and watch it die, but everybody thought this would be the last
festival. Well, they found out. Well, there wasn't any festival.
Oh, okay.
That's the thing.
Oh, I see. Well, you're right. Yeah. This was the festival.
This was the festival, and it had such a huge turnout that the promoters said, "Well, this isn't the death of bluegrass. This is a whole rebirth of it."
That it's an amazing thing because we're here at this incredible Gray Fox Festival, which has developed out of that concept. But so many artists come to these, and they're so used to this has really become because they don't get airplay other than guys like you and whatever I can do. They don't get heard. They get heard here, and they sell product here, and that's the nature of the business now.
It's the nature of the business, and it's the love of the music. So many of our bands are part time. They all have real, as we call them,
real jobs,
daytime jobs.
Right.
But also, I can't think of any other form of music where about 20 or 30% of the people listening to it also pick.
Right.
I mean, there'll be people at this festival that are over in their camping area that have not yet once come down here to stand in front of the stage.
That's right.
They've been busy picking and
that's
jamming.
Right. Yeah, if you think about it, it doesn't happen in jazz festivals.
No.
It doesn't happen in rock festivals.
No.
That's a unique thing because as we sit here now, if you and I had to get up and head back that way, we would find people sitting and picking.
That's right.
Red Wine's on the stage, fabulous band from Italy, but there are people down the hill that are doing the same thing.
Or they intended to come up and see the band, but they got caught up in a jam.
Isn't that amazing? And this festival, I don't know how the early ones were, but this one you have at Gray Fox, if you have family members who aren't that into bluegrass, you can take your kids and find things for them to do.
There's kids going on all the time. There's dancing that goes on for people who like to do square dancing and clog dancing. Oh, yeah.
It's amazing. And so they become like these little temporary portable communities.
Almost
like cities.
This is a city, and it'll be gone by Monday.
That's right.
That's what's so crazy about it. And then you just have this Bluegrass Academy for kids that is so unbelievable, where they take 150 of these kids, and I mean kids from 5 up until maybe 14, and since Thursday they have been teaching them 4 or 5 numbers. They've all had individual instructors for the particular instruments they play, and on Sunday afternoon, the 150 of these kids are going to get up on that stage, and they're going to play 3 numbers.
Really?
And the audience is going to just cheer them on as the future of bluegrass music.
And some of their teachers may have been some of the greatest players on the planet because they all fill in and help teach that.
They still are.
It's just amazing. I can't tell you how many people I see come here Thursday when they may not be ready to perform yet, and you see them all the time. They might play once, but they never leave as performers. As artists, they stick around to participate in all those things, too.
They do that. And, of course, we have the fabulous Grillbilly Parade, which will be at 5 o'clock. If you think that the New Orleans Mardi Gras is something.
I actually described it to a friend of mine. I said, look, think of everything down here, but put it up in this context. As similar to like a parade down in New Orleans. They march all around. It's a phenomenal event.
Yeah, I marched last year, but I think I'm going to get dragged a ride this year.
Are you going to be in the chair waving? Are you going to be in the car waving as you go by?
Well, I'm not going to throw coins.
Don't throw any white bead. It's not going to do you any good here.
I'll tell you one thing that I've been involved in the history of bluegrass, but even more so the history of pre-bluegrass, old-time country music, going back to Fiddle and John Carson in 1924. But my idol and the man that I have devoted many, many hours to researching and getting stories about is Uncle Dave Macon.
I knew that. Just talk about Uncle Dave Macon a little bit.
He was the first superstar of the Grand Ole Opry. He came there in 1926, and he was there until 3 weeks before before he died in March of 1952. He didn't get into show business until he was 50 years old. Before that, he was a mule man. He had the Macon, Midway, Mitchell, Mule, and Wagon Transportation Company, and it just hauled produce between Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and Woodbury, Tennessee, and Uncle Dave's house was in the middle of the route, so he spent an overnight before he continued on to the next town. But the trucks put him out of business in 1919.
Oh, okay.
But all that time, I mean, since the time he was 14, and he was born in 1870, he had picked the banjo, and he would literally stop the wagon and get out and jam with former slaves that were on the, in the cabins along his route.
And he was learning more stuff.
He was learning and swapping songs with him and all that, and finally when he realized that he had, well, his sister said, you know, you can pick money out of that banjo, Dave, and that's what he did.
Really?
He was already an established recording artist by the time the Grand Ole Opry went on, and he just, he loved radio, he made tons of personal appearances. The historian of Rutherford County, Tennessee, called him the Elvis of Rutherford County, because he really was the most popular star and personality of that part of Tennessee.
He was a rock star.
He was a rock star.
And his style of entertaining was, there was entertainment value to it.
Oh, my God, total.
And he would play, not the way that Scruggs developed, but he had an old style playing, but he also did these, you know, throwing things around
he
and moving
the
all
banjo up in the air and turned it around. He was a vaudevillian. He was a 19th century man in the 20th century.
Thank you. Yes, vaudevillian. That's the perfect description.
And he loved being on the radio.
Yes.
He did not like making records because they had to tie his foot down and the needle would jump out of the groove. But I brought up Uncle Dave because we have a festival, which I just emceed last weekend, in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. His farm was just 8 miles out of Murfreesboro. It's Uncle Dave Macon Days. And it's 3 days of competition in both bluegrass and old-time music, but also clog dancing and buck dancing.
Really?
And if you would go down there and see these anywhere from age 5 up until age 65 out there clogging and buck dancing in these
contests. Which are two different things.
They're two different things. One is more, I think it has a more roots in the black culture, which is the buck dancing.
Right.
And the clog dancing is more Appalachian. And most of them can do both.
And for our viewers, the clog dancing involves a little more leg action.
Yes. Yeah, it does.
All of our viewers.
But it is so amazing how many young people are in that. And then we had a this year competition in old-time music and bluegrass bands, both bands, and we had about 9 or 10 outstanding young bluegrass bands competing, and even more shocking was 9 or 10 old-time bands. I mean, these are 20-year-olds playing Gin Tanner and the Skillet Lickers. And they probably don't even know who he is.
That's right. That's
but they're
right.
Out there, and they got the showmanship down, and you're looking at, oh, my God, this is the Grand Ole Opry in 1938. But we have, if this is the case, I said to him, you know, 20 years ago, you kids weren't into this music. Where are you finding this? Oh, we see it on YouTube all the time.
Good point.
Yeah, and these kids are learning about old-time music and bluegrass music, and they're doing it. So I think the future of this music...
Isn't it amazing that YouTube, which is the computer availability thing only, may come back and save those types of music?
Yeah.
Because young kids who spend so much time on their computer can stumble across, maybe they're looking for something else, and they stumble across a video of an old-time player, and then they get that trail of it, and all of a sudden they're hooked on those things.
And they pass it on to other people their age.
I've never thought about that.
Well, I never thought about it either until they told me.
Until they told you, okay.
But, it just refreshes your heart to know that this music is not going to die at all.
I'm glad to hear you say that.
With the young people, and no matter what trends it goes, there's still the basics that people play. And I'm a moldy fig, I do like, you know, we're writing some great songs to this day.
Right.
That are done in the traditional bluegrass style. I can't think of any other genre of music where you can sing about mother having Alzheimer's and then off to want to go back to the farm and something about a truck. I mean, it's not just I love you and you don't love me.
That's
you know?
Right. That's right.
And, of course, the great bluegrass gospel music that we have. So Bill Monroe is the only person in the world who can claim that he has singularly invented a form of music.
Right.
Together the seminal bluegrass band, and Mozart can't say that, Beethoven
right,
can't say
you're
that.
Right. And you announced on the stage, I didn't know this about the stamp. Who was talking about the...
Yeah.
Tell me, because I didn't know that, so tell the listeners, I didn't know.
We have been fighting for years to get a stamp for Bill Monroe. I mean, if Betty Boop got one, there's no reason why Bill Monroe can't have a stamp. So it's been rejected down through the years, and the people just went and petitioned again, and finally it's been accepted, and I got that word on Facebook from Bill Monroe's grandson, Jimbo, and I'm not too pleased with the design of the stamp, but hey, at least it's a stamp, you know?
He's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
He's in the Country Hall of Fame. He is the bluegrass. I mean, nobody else quite makes those claims, and they're finally getting around to giving the guy a stamp.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's about time. Thank you for working on that.
Now, if I could get one for Uncle Dave Macon, I'd be a happy camper.
That'll be next. That'll be next.
I'll work on it.
You'll work on that. I'm going to call you now. You don't have to respond, but we've talked about this before. Thanks for doing this, first of all. I didn't mean to cut you off, but I wanted to chat with you, and I've always been admired what you've done and knew of who you were until I started coming here and get a chance to meet you. To me, we said this on the air a minute ago, you are the Toastmaster General of bluegrass.
I love it. Thank you.
I think it's perfect. You're the guy. You even have your badges on your hat instead of on your jacket like Georgie Jessel did.
Yeah, I do, yeah.
If you pin all those on your shirt, you can show up to whatever event that goes on and tell stories and be a... I think that's a great compliment.
Well,
for people like us who remember.
Well, that's true. It also, the whole bluegrass community, I mean, I hate that term. It's so sociological. But, we have security. We really don't need security, but we have it, you know?
It's never going to be the dominant. It's always going to have that hard kernel. It's going to get bigger and smaller. It's not ever going to go away.
It's niche music.
It's niche music, and it's in its absolute perfect definition is niche music. It's not going to take... You know, that movies come out. Oh, brother. Oh, now we're going to... No, you're going to... But it's not going to get beyond that. You just have to save that kernel and make sure that's available for future generations. And it'll always be there.
We need another Oh, Brother at this point. It's been 10 years. So
yes, that's
now, there is a proposal, and they're trying to raise money for it. They've already got the music tracks down for a movie on Bill Monroe and his affair, I guess is the word I have to use, with Bessie Lee Malden, his bass player. And they've got all the music tracks laid down.
I'm shocked. I'm shocked.
I know, I'm sorry.
I've heard about this before, but not in public.
But they've got the performers identified. I've never heard of either actor. They do have the music tracks laid down.
No
the
kidding.
Gibson brothers are doing the Blue Sky
Excellent.
Boys.
Excellent.
Ricky Skaggs is doing Uncle Dave Macon. And Del McCurry will do all the Monroe singing.
The lyric. Oh, the singing.
Yeah,
he'll do the voice.
So, you know, they'll do lip syncing on
all right,
the
well,
singing
great.
And all that.
Well, you could be Uncle Dave Macon.
I'd rather be his manager. Too much energy to be Uncle Dave.
This is Bill, I appreciate this so much, man.
My pleasure.
I've enjoyed meeting you the last couple years that I made it up. I'm happy to be here and be part of this celebration, which is still just amazing to me, the openness and the inclusiveness and the fact that they treat me like I belong here. And I don't know that I belong in any part
family,
of this.
Your family here.
That's what
Once
I feel
part
like.
Of it. I hope that your listeners get a chance to listen into the Bluegrass Ramble at some point. It's on every Sunday night from 9 p.m. till midnight Eastern Time at WCNY.org.
We'll make sure they know about that.
Thank you.
Thank you, man. I'll see you. I'm not leaving yet. You're not leaving yet. We'll see each other for the rest of the weekend.
Yeah.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
That was fun. I was so thrilled to... it's difficult. There's a lot of loud music going on up there, and that's not too far from the High Meadow stage. And as you could hear... Red Wine, I believe they had come back on stage because an act had just couldn't make it to the festival site. So Red Wine, I think, was doing their second set, volunteering to do so, and did a great job. And it's a little portable recorder. Bill made that very easy for me. I'm usually much more relaxed and much slower, but I also felt like I knew he had duties. He was in between MC duties, so he had stuff to do. I was just sort of hanging around, making sure that... I could catch whoever I wanted to. So, Bill Knowlton, thank you so much, man. I really appreciate it. That's the guy. That's the godfather of bluegrass radio. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. I don't care what anybody says. That's what he is.